Everyday life can start to feel a little, well, routine. But every once in a while, maybe you notice something small that makes you wonder, why are things the way they are? Why can you buy CDs at coffee shops? These moments are called ruptures, and they're a gateway to thinking about larger cultural norms that impact our everyday lives. My name is Lily Forrester, and I am the host of the new anthropology podcast series, Life in Anth. On our show, we talk about phenomena small and large. Why do some colleges have great relationships with their surrounding towns and others not? How is power demonstrated in a recreational fitness setting? We have so many questions to answer and so much anthropology to learn, and you can join in our musing on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Spotify. We'll see you there. Hello, and welcome back to Life in Anth. I'm super excited to be here today with my guest and permanent member of Life in Anth going forward, Kim. Kim, welcome to the show.
Hello, Lily. How are you? Welcome back, right?
Yes, welcome back. Welcome back. In fact, this is Kim's not actually a guest. Kim is the mastermind behind the editing and all of the effects that you hear in the show normally. So a big thanks goes out to Kim for making this all possible.
I appreciate that. It's really been a pleasure. It's been great being a part of the Life in Anth podcast journey. And I'm excited to kind of do a wrap up of this season and talk about what's coming next.
Yeah. And I'm glad. So we actually had a conversation, talked about how we can breathe some more life into the show, maybe like heavier on the life alongside the Anth and give it some conversation so that it's just, you know, even easier to listen to. After all, it is our mission statement to break down the barriers between the academia of it and the general public who it's intended to serve in the first place. So we're super excited about this next phase of Life in Anth. And like Kim said, we're going to be covering a lot of the topics that we went through this past season and breaking down sort of how they relate to life today. So just to kick us off, I would love to get your thoughts, Kim, a little bit about, you know, when you were working on the show, what was your exposure to anthropology at the start of it, and where are you at now?
That's a great question, and you know, thank you so much for having me on, not just behind the scenes, but now on the camera to talk about this. And you know, to answer your question, I think for me, when I thought about, you know, anthropology, it was kind of in the form of like Margaret Mead or people that were doing those types of, you know, famous, really, really well-known anthropologists that probably a lot of people know. And my ideas about it were, it was very academic, kind of scientific, and something that impacted probably everyone's life, but it really wasn't obvious that I was doing that. And then when I started to get into the show and, you know, listen 100 times with the editing, I was like, oh, that's a really interesting concept. And it made me think about how the topics that you were discussing were impacting my life and other people's lives. So I would say that, you know, prior to work on the podcast, it was a very general, big understanding, 5,000, you know, feet view of it. And since then, I've really been able to see how anthropology really impacts our lives in very granular ways.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's so interesting to hear you say it's scientific, because I think, you know, it is a social science. And they always tell you in school that way back in the day, there was no distinction between that and a hard science. And we've come such a long way since then, where really, I think anthropology is, it can't be removed from that social element. And I think it just shapes our sociopolitical landscape so heavily. And it's a framework. And that's what I always think about it when people ask me, what is anthropology? Truthfully, it is, there's a science to it, because people do what people do. And so I guess, you know, we have to unpack what it is that people do and why. But on top of that, it infiltrates almost every interaction that we have, every relationship that we have. And so I think, you know, this is a great place to launch into, you know, who we are in the greater landscape, sort of everything through that framework.
I agree. And I also think that, you know, for me, it gave a name to some of these things that you kind of feel in society in general, and maybe even your own personal experiences. It's like, oh, okay, this is not my imagination, or maybe there were things that I had thought about, but with the definitions and, you know, the science and the research behind it, it really helped to put it all in a nice envelope, so to speak, that makes more sense. Some of the experiences or things that I notice or observed in life in general.
Absolutely. Yeah. It definitely makes you unpack a lot of interactions you have quite a bit more, I think. And I think that's actually an interesting thing to start our concept review. Just thinking about, you know, our place in the world, I have two things to bring back from episode one. First, I would like to mention emic and edic. So what we're talking about is in-group and out-group in a very simplistic explanation. But essentially, you know, if you are observing a group of people and their interactions together as anthropological, but you're not involved in that, you are taking the edic point of view. So you're an outsider looking in. Whereas if you are observing an interaction that you just had and you are observing the culture that you are directly within, you are actually looking at it from the emic. And that pervades when we talk about anthropological, how shall I put this? We talk about anything that can be seen as anthropological. That emic and edic is an essential part of our positionality. And that's something that we establish in anthropology all the time because, you know, when you think about how you feel and digest a certain interaction, a certain relationship, it's impossible to remove your own identity from that. And that's where we get this idea of positionality and how we can apply it when we're writing so that if a reader, for example, is digesting something I've written, they might know that my identity as an LGBTQ young woman living in Boston might have something to do with what I say about it.
Yeah, and that, you know, that first episode really, I think, set the stage very well and laid the groundwork because I think everyone can really relate to those concepts. They may not have heard of them before, but we've all experienced them, whether it's a family dynamic or a workplace situation or interpersonal relationships. And they're, you know, it's all fluid. It's like, okay, you're in your work situation. There's a positionality that you have, but as soon as you leave that and go be with your friends, it's a different type of scenario. And for me, you know, having you really go through that helped me understand how these relationships play themselves out and how these concepts play themselves out. And it's really helped me to, you know, think through certain things like, okay, let me stop and think about episode one and how these concepts are actually playing themselves out. Because I think oftentimes, especially when conflict, you know, arises, it's easy to become very emotional about those things. But when you think of it from the perspective of, okay, like Lily says, these concepts, what's going on here? What's your positionality? What's your voice in this? Relationships are off, you know, power dynamics change. They're often ad hoc. And it really helps to kind of remove some of the emotionality around some of those topics, issues, and situations that people find themselves in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think just to sort of jump on something you said there that I think really pertains to some other terms that we talked about is, you know, you said that when you go to work, you're one person, you're involved in one culture. And when you leave and you go with your friends, you're involved in something else. One thing I will say is that anthropology says that every single group of people has a culture. It's impossible not to have a culture. So, you know, there's been debate about how small that group needs to be, but they say there is a culture of any group. We'll call it 3+ because there's debate on the two. But with that, it makes me wonder, do you think that part of that changing is related to what is considered appropriate in the workplace and what is considered appropriate among friends and the sort of unwritten or written rules that exist in those two settings?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, for people that may come from underrepresented groups, you know, there's a lot of things that come into play when you're navigating different types of scenarios like you described. Okay, so there's a workplace situation. Maybe you're the only one of a few females in a certain dynamic. Maybe you're an engineer and it's a male-dominated office space, so there's that dynamic going on. Maybe you're then in a family situation where you know, there's some power dynamics that play themselves out between mother, father, sister, brother, and you're the baby of the family, and there's expectations of you, or maybe you're the oldest one, and there's expectations of you. And then also with your friend groups, you know, there might be dynamics within a friend group. And so each one of those places, you might have to wear different hats. And I think a lot of people do that. It's not just people from, I'd say, minority groups, but I think everyone does that, but may not even really be aware of it necessarily. Just maybe like, oh, well, that's what we do. I think when I'm hanging out with these people, this is who I am, versus when I'm hanging out with these people. And I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with that, quote unquote, but I think it's something that is good to be aware of.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's just so widespread that when there is something wrong with it, and it absolutely can be used as a weapon, but is also like an inevitability of a lot of different social groups. I mean, I think back to when I was a child and I had my school friends and my basketball friends. And even though there was nothing inherently different about those two groups, the cultures of them were different just based on the specific personalities who were there and the circumstances we existed in, and how if I had a birthday party, it would be weird to have those two worlds because the two rules are different within that. And the rules that we live by, and anthropology says that's because of another concept in episode one, cultural relativism, that the rules of one culture are different than the rules of another culture. And so when you're observing another culture, you can't apply your lens through yours to say this is inherently right or wrong, or better or worse, primitive or advanced. All of that is actually not concrete, and that it's all relative to the culture that you're in, and that the specific goals of those cultures may actually be different. And so you cannot apply the same scale across cultures.
And that makes sense. And probably people inherently understand that. But I think the podcast and anthropology, that, you know, the terms make it real clear. It's like, okay, this is what we're all experiencing. There's a term for that. You're not making this up, and you're not feeling something strange. And I think the question is, you know, how do we interact with all of that, and how do we navigate it and come to terms with that and kind of make, I guess, make peace with some of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think anthropology still struggles with that. I don't think that there is an answer. And that's why at the end of every episode so far, we've asked, well, what do we do from here? And we can never really offer a concrete answer. I think that the answer is always be aware of it and try to exist in a way that is, I guess, by the anthropology book, in a way.
But, you know, I get the impression that, and this is a question for you, I get the impression that a lot of the studies, or maybe not a lot of the studies, but one of the goals is to kind of understand conflict, right? And how to maybe ameliorate or negate conflict between people in different social interactions. Is that right? Am I making this up?
I think it is the most common application of it, sort of colloquially. I think anthropology, it's so interesting. The breadth of studies, you know, we've talked about a lot of concepts that are sort of very broad and engaging, and you can see pretty clearly how they tie into these concepts that we've studied. But there are so many divisions of anthropology. You would not have a very easy time observing maybe ethnomusicology and understanding how that is directly applied to issues of conflict. I think that anthropology, what it is, and it sounds so fluffy, but we try to understand what people do. And given that conflict is a very large part of the human experience, it is necessary that we address all of the conflict that arises from just basic human existence. And so I would say yes, although that is probably not, I would say yes, that is probably not what most anthropologists would say. They would offer you the larger explanation that I just did.
Which is the anthropologists are trying to understand
what people do.
What people
conflict,
do.
Yep. Conflict is a core part of the human experience.
Now, are they also trying to understand why people do those things?
Absolutely. And that, I think, is a really good call out. I think that when we talk about why people do these things, we have to observe like the structures of power that we exist within, which, you know, as you know, all we did all series was talk about the structures of power that exist before we exist, and then we come to exist as actors in. So I think that's something really that's been interesting for me and writing the show is thinking so many different ways about these different concepts and trying to figure out, you know, how do situations, circumstances, and relationships in my life reflect some of these, because everyone's do.
I agree. And then I think, you know, back to your original question of what, how has my view of anthropology expanded, you know, since I've been doing the podcast. And it really just has made me think through a lot of things, even as we see current events, situations put themselves out. It's like the whole power dynamic. And I think it's power is often very fluid. You know, sometimes it appears that, oh, this group's powerful. But if you really peel back the layer, it's nothing's etched in stone. Definitely not power dynamics, and they can change based on you know, the people involved, the situation, time of year. You
know, oh, yeah.
There's a whole lot of elements that go into that. So it's really made me think through that. And also, you know, think through, well, how can things, you know, how can maybe something be resolved if you can think through some of these situations? Because it's, you're thinking about your own personal situation, but it helps to think through what might those other people be going through as well, and what's their positionality, or what might their framework be from an anthropological lens.
And I love what you said about how it's not so etched in stone. You know, I think that there are broad sweeping things that in general are really true and do require us to acknowledge it in some way. And I think that that's been, I think, broadly acknowledged in the anthropological community. But if we can call back to the episode we did on power of touch in a recreational fitness setting, a lot of the discussion there was about power as it exists in a circumstance. So we talked about power within the bounds of the recreational fitness room and how there that person is an instructor. They have all the power. They're a performer. And then when they leave, they're just a person again. And so, you know, the power is sort of bound to that one room within those walls. It is so granular all the way up to the macro level, really, where we can see that these dynamics of power are playing out.
Oh, yeah. And especially with that episode, it made me really think about, I had a career in the spa industry for quite a while. Really, really loved working in that industry. And it was always a matter of you're in a tight space, you know, with a stranger, usually, oftentimes you're meeting someone for the first time, and you have to get into judging them because it's a spa treatment, and you don't have a whole lot of time to get into. We don't have a half an hour to break down some of these barriers, and you have to move real fast to get people comfortable, because touch is the essence of these things. So it really made me think about that. And you could have, so I worked at a very well-known spa. We had high-profile people coming in there. And it's like, I literally would see this person. Like, didn't I just see you on like a financial reporting show, Mr. CEO? But here they are.
You know,
it's all about power, right? And in that situation, it's you see that person in the outside world, and it's different when it's in a more intimate space.
Absolutely.
And all those things get stripped away. We don't have a whole lot of time.
And in that space, you're considered the expert, you know. So if you might not in the outside world be considered an expert next to somebody who is a CEO, a guru in the financial world, all of that, that would all make up the positionality of this individual who, when they enter this room, actually does not have the power to wield touch, whereas you, the expert in the room, you do.
100%. And if I ran into that person at a restaurant, you know, an hour later, it would be like, no touching. We don't know each other.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting, because it's all, a lot of it's situational, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's about the written and unwritten rules that come in each circumstance that you encounter, and who is deemed to be the expert or the powerful in each circumstance. So I think that is a really, really interesting kind of tie in there. I would also ask you a little bit about that, just to draw it out. Did you, when you were working in this spa, obviously it's not a lot of time, did you ever have, like, I would say, verbal interactions with these people? Did you have repeat clients who came to really like you? That sort of thing. How did it go?
Yes. It was, I love that industry. It was a very good industry for me to be in. It was a great opportunity to do, healing work. And I met a lot of really great, interesting people. And I did oftentimes have repeat clients, people that would come back. And, it was just one of those things where if you're meeting someone new, it was always, I would always just kind of say, well, you know what? This is just going to go my way. There's not going to be a problem. There's kind of like a prayer. But you just never know. You see a name on a sheet of paper and you got to go greet this person. But it's like from the very beginning, even before meeting the person, say, like, this interaction is going to go well because that's my intention. Intention is this person is in need of healing. I'm here to do that. And I'm going to do my best to be respectful of their boundaries and my boundaries and all those things. So you have to navigate a lot. You don't have a whole lot of time, like I said, but I think in those types of situations, I'm the one setting the tone.
Absolutely.
This is gonna be a professional situation. I don't know what you're thinking, but this is what I'm thinking. This is how this is gonna go down. And that was kind of my attitude. It was always my attitude.
Yeah, and I'm so curious, about that setting versus the fitness setting, which are, it's two sort of similar, I would say, in the same vein, self-care. And I think that's something that I wonder the relationship between you and the client versus the instructor and the client, and the sort of parasocial relationship that may or may not come out or fall out from that. Because, as you know from the episode on fitness, people do generate a parasocial relationship with their instructor. So I'm wondering, if that's the same in the spa industry or if it's different, and if we can sort of speculate on why.
That's an interesting question. I think because I worked in, multiple situations, like a resort type places. So people were coming there for specific reasons and then leaving. Then in other environments where people were maybe showing up more regularly, like once a week or something like that. For me, generally speaking, I really didn't socialize with people outside of those situations because, the boundary was really important to maintaining. And I didn't really want to be friends with people under those circumstances. And so, and even with conversations, I sometimes people talk. I was just one of those therapists who's like, I really don't necessarily want to hear too many fuck your problems. Because it's kind of distracting.
Oh, I'm
So,
sure.
but some people, they have to let things out. And so you allow for them. I certainly wouldn't tell somebody to stop talking, but I didn't necessarily encourage that kind of thing. Some people do. I mean, some people like to know their life story and what's going on and the problems with the kids and the husband and this, that, and the other. That wasn't necessarily the way I like to handle my business like that. But I know some people did and do. I just think it's good to keep the professional boundaries professional and the friendship. And I really didn't blur those two things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that we talked about with fitness, is there's slightly more difficulty in maintaining that professional boundary, which is my, I'm positing that that's why this parasocial relationship may be more prevalent in the fitness space than it is in the spa space. I think maybe it is literally the setting that you have a group of people who come together and you're performing for all of them at once. And I think that that group dynamic may be what is causing room for people to idolize these fitness instructors. Whereas if you have a one-on-one setting, it's more person to person and you can maintain that boundary. So that's just what, off the noggin. I'm not sure that's what it is, but that's something that I would say would be like my anthropological take at the start.
And that's really interesting. I mean, did you find that, or do you find that people then socialize with the fitness instructors, or do they do things outside of that setting?
Oh, absolutely.
I
They
don't know.
absolutely socialize with them. Yeah, it'll be a line to walk out the door from a fitness class, because people feel really changed and really moved by the instructors who are helping them achieve their goals and who are really like an idealized version of a person to these people. You know, it's a very disciplined, fit, healthy person who is charismatic. And it is a performance some days. I think, you know, I've spoken to a lot of fitness instructors who talk about the difficulty of always having to be on. And that's because it is expected of them by their clients who are paying money to come spend 45 minutes basically doing something that they could do by themselves. Yes.
You can do this on your own, right?
Yeah, but they don't. And or they really prefer not to. They like to have the community of people there all listening to a single instructor. And I think that when there is that setup that you are standing in classroom or you're standing in front of, like even a group of people up on stage, wherever it is, which, you know, we can tie back to even the Boy Genius episode where we talked about like cultural capital and performativity and all of that, that degree of separation between one person and the rest, it creates something powerful. And I think that people really cling to that and try to develop a relationship with it. It's almost like trying to achieve power through association.
Interesting. I mean, you know, just to dig a little deeper into that, with the anthropological concepts that you presented, are they pretty much global concepts, or are some of them just specific to American culture, or can they be broadly aligned with other cultures as well?
So the concepts are, in their most ideal form, supposed to be applicable to all cultures. So even to say like American culture, we can bring that down to the culture of one family. So these concepts are supposed to be, you know, that performativity, just to call back, the idea of performativity is that your identity is something that is applied to you externally at the time that you're born, that you are, you know, for me, I'm born, I'm 25% Korean. I am a woman. I'm a second child. I live in Los Angeles or wherever I have lived since then. But a lot of these ideas that are not internal, they are not predetermined, but they are determined the moment I'm born. And that my identity and everything that I understand about myself has come because of that. And I perform my identity every day. So as a callback, that's the definition of performativity. That is supposed to be a global concept, that I will perform that just as someone born today in Japan will perform their identity.
Well, it's interesting because I just want to go back to what you were talking about with, the, you know, a fitness instructor being in front of a class, and that separation creates this idea that this person's on a pedestal and that the other person is there to learn. And it's feels like it's also something that's, and I know you touched on this in the episode, that is an opening possibly for, you know, abuse or the mistreatment of that relationship.
Absolutely. And we did touch on that with wielding the power of touch, where, you know, that kind of power, I will say in the fitness space, we used it as a sort of light example. It's not so commonly, to my knowledge, it's not like so commonly abused. I would say I've attended so many fitness classes, and I think that it is just an interesting framework. However, I will say that these structures of power, where if you are considered to be the powerful one in the situation and you are regarded that way widely, you have a lot more sway. And then you can abuse that power without as many repercussions. So, I mean, we can draw this all the way up to some of the atrocities that like President Trump has committed, where he has been convicted of sexual assault. And he, being the powerful one, he just doesn't face repercussions the way that a lot of people, most people, would.
And then, you know, from an anthropological perspective, when you have that type of dynamic, you know, someone's here, they're kind of on some kind of pedestal, whether they stole the pedestal or was put there or however they got there. You know, people sit there and there's a lot of, you know, idol worship that goes on, not just here, but in other cultures. What is it that, from the perspective of the person on the pedestal, anthropologically speaking, that says, okay, now I'm going to go out there and be abusive with that as opposed to I'm going to try to do some good?
I wish I had a really strong answer there, but I would say once again that performativity is baked into that concept. That, you know, once you are identified as a person of power, you perform a person of power. And so if you are, I think that people are always looking for ways to express their power. And when I say express their power, I think it would be reasonable to say that abusing that power is somewhat synonymous, because people test the bounds of that. They want to know how much power they have. And ultimately, power breeds power. And so I think it is maybe through abuses of that power that degenerate, you know, micro tears and come back stronger, as it were. So I think through these abuses of power, through the enactment of power, they continue to communicate that they are, in fact, in power.
It's just interesting because, you know, I've given that topic a lot of thought. You know, why is it that we often see people when they get elevated, whether they took it, but took the pedestal or put there, however they got there, the choice is to demonstrate their power in a negative way as opposed to a positive way. And it's not to say that everyone does that, but it's often, it feels like that's an approach that people take. And it's like, well, why is that from the what would the anthropologist say about that?
I think the anthropologist, unfortunately, I think would say that people are always seeking more power. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't think that any one person can gain an amount of power without someone else losing it. And I think there are a lot of questions that sound almost philosophical around this idea. Can somebody who is extraordinarily wealthy truly be an ethical actor? I don't think that anthropology has a really solid answer there. But there is an interesting idea that you are your impact in a way. And so if you never come into that kind of money, you can never be held to that standard. We'd never know how you would act. So even though we have the framework that says nobody with that power uses it for good entirely, nobody sacrifices their power, we can't really apply that to people who've never had the chance to demonstrate that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. And I think it's, you know, there's so much nuance to that because, like we've been talking about, power shift depending on the relationships you're in, the groups you're in, time of day, year, whatever. There's a whole lot of things that go into that. But I think when I look at things going on and my observations about a lot of power situations, it's just this question of why do people seem to want to amass power to then go out and try to inflict harm on people? I just don't understand. Does the brain get rewired? Because for me, that's not really a power play. My vision of power is very different. So it's just something that I don't necessarily understand. I personally feel that, and I'm not an anthropologist, I'm a human being that loves to observe things. It feels like there just really needs to be a rethinking of expression of power, because I don't know if we just have a lot of hurt people out there that are just trying to get power to hurt other people. It's like, what is that? Because like I said, my view of power often has nothing to do with what I observe. So other powerful people demonstrating.
I think that anthropology doesn't have like a super solid answer. And I think that's like a really big problem. But I think that the answer is that power exists to preserve and grow power. And so I think that's why we see people, I don't think we covered this in the show yet, but there is a concept called the paradox of proximity to power. And what that means is if you are not exactly the ruling class, but you're like kind of close to the ruling class, you have this like idea in your head that someday you could get there. And so your goal is to uphold status quo. Because if the system gets dismantled, you have the highest probability of actually being in a position of lesser power. Because right now you're very close in your mind to the powerful. This would be like the upper middle class would be an example of this. Probably the most common example of this would be the upper middle class. They think that one day, you know, they're next in line to be billionaires, but it never really happens. Even though it never really happens, you still think like, if I can just uphold the status quo, then
on the nose,
yes, then I will get there eventually and I'll be the billionaire. And so I think that that really demonstrates this idea that people who have power live in fear of losing it and therefore exist to grow the gap between the powerful and the underserviced, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think that the issue and the topic of power is a really intriguing conversation. And I think more people really should have the conversation, because I think there's, when you look at our country, I'll speak to that because I'm most familiar with it. There, I think there are these ideas that, you know, people at the top of the food chain, whoever they may be, have this idea that, you know, everybody else is clamoring to get their position and knock them out. It's like, well, I don't know how true that is. I think a lot of people I know are just interested in living a comfortable, decent life, taking care of themselves and their family and their community, not necessarily trying to knock someone out of the box. So I think there's a lot of paranoia around that. And sure, there are probably some people that are interested in doing that, but I'm not sure how widespread that thinking is. And I think because there's that thinking, there are these efforts that are made to try to block people, keep people from this and keep people from that. And then it creates what you're, or you say, now you create something that you really are afraid of, because it's like, well, maybe you should just leave people alone. Then maybe they wouldn't have any reason to try to do anything. But you're now trying to block and miss and hold on, and you got to maintain that. And so now it's creating this conflict that may not have existed prior to you behaving that way. So that's just my non-anthropological two cents.
Yeah, and I think in a perfect world that would be the case. But you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the show Yellow Jackets.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, yeah. I'm watching it right now, so it's on the mind. But, you know, maybe to reach back further in the literary canon, The Lord of the Flies is posit something actually fairly anthropological, which is that if you remove, let's say you removed all of the billionaires who are the bad actors, that in some form or another, the economy, in the case of the billionaires, the economy would seek a new kingpin. So if all billionaires were removed and it was left to only like the upper middle class, they'd be now the most powerful, most privileged, and they would now have the most ability to move upward. And so because of that, there would fall into place a new structure. The ceiling would be like a little bit lower for a little while, but eventually it would fall into these same like structures of power, because it's not always about the individuals as much as it is about the structure, which some people say there are structural anthropologists. It's, I think right now it's fallen out of favor. But structuralist anthropology, we did talk about that in episode one as well. I believe heavily in structures of power, but structuralist anthropology is a little bit even stricter than that in its definition. It's largely that a person exists somewhat as a canvas, and then they are created in personality by the structures that are imposed upon them. So, you know, I don't believe that people are canvases necessarily. I think that there are things that are personality traits. I won't go on record saying I'm a structuralist anthropologist. But, you know, structures, I think, are a very key concept here that says, you know, we would posit as anthropologists probably that if you were to remove the powerful class, your problem wouldn't be solved. We would then find a new powerful class.
100%. And I think that's, you know, just a larger issue of, you know, this whole notion of people clamoring for power and said, well, what's your definition of power? For some people, maybe they're powerful because they're healthy, they're in, you know, strong relationships. They're not necessarily seeking to use that personal power to overtake somebody. But I think with civilizations and societies that have been up and running for hundreds and thousands of years, certain things are now set up to be a certain kind of way. So it's hard to even imagine them not being this way. And I'm not suggesting that they necessarily shouldn't be this way. I think it's just a good conversation to have of like, okay, you want power to do what? Okay. And oftentimes the pursuit of power means that someone else is suffering. And that's the issue that I take with it. It's like, okay, you want your little power thing. That's fine. Why are people suffering for you? Like, who says that you should be the person to have all that and everyone else should suffer? That's the question. Who died and left you boss? That's my question.
Yeah. You know, I think that we're going to have to do a necessary sneak peek into season two here with this one. But I think what you are referring to is actually a very interesting. It's an interesting anthropological concept that I think is owed an episode. So I don't want to give away much. But it is called the Protestant work ethic. And just to sort of give a glimpse into what that means, you know, in a broad sense, what it means is that we were put on this earth by God to work and to make money. And I think that's actually very prevalent in a lot of work spaces. So, you know, the person who is considered most godlike, and that's not always applied in a Christian sense or even a religious sense at all, but just to say the person who is the most godlike is the one who makes the most money. And that is heavily applied in capitalist cultures, but I would argue is actually applied fairly globally at this point. I'm afraid that globalization has somewhat killed a lot of anti-capitalist spaces in the world. I think that the world has become progressively more capitalist as globalization has occurred. And it's really all about chasing that next dollar, which is supposedly when you get wealthier in society, you're considered better.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that conversation because I've thought about this a lot and have had conversations about this a lot. And, you know, where I fall on that is, I think people need to understand that not everyone, let me back up a little bit. I think oftentimes what we hear is there's these, you know, this class warfare and, you know, certain elements at the top of the food chain, they think everyone's jealous and envious. And it's like, well, you know, slow down. Okay, let's back up. Like, no one's necessarily. I'll speak for myself, necessarily jealous of your money and whatever you're pursuing. The questions that I have is when you start judging other people who are not pursuing exactly what you're pursuing, and then you have all this name calling and put downs and all this stuff because people aren't doing what you're doing, therein lies the problem that I specifically have. And why do you think that your idea it's the best idea? Maybe that should be up for debate, but people don't even seem to really want to have the debate. And, you know, my question about that is, well, if you're so confident in your belief system, why don't you want to have an open conversation about it?
Yeah, I think it's a fair point.
I'm just wondering.
Because I think so many people feel that is the right answer is that it's communicated downward. So really, you know, in a broad sense, I think it's largely just about your money. And I think that's the most widely applicable one. If you can like think down to micro cultures, like in sports teams, they award the people who like get the most points and that sort of thing. Those people become the captains and then they wield power, even if it's sort of a figurehead but they are allegedly in a position of power. And I think that all of that falls out from the Protestant work ethic, which says that if you have the highest output, you are the closest to God.
Which is so interesting because, you know, and I know we'll get deeper into it, but, you know, based on my understanding of some of the basic Christian fundamental values, it's actually in direct juxtaposition with all those values because Jesus was a carpenter's son and the riches were in the heart, right, in the soul. So it's just interesting. Right? Because on one hand, people are like, oh my God, you know, these values and these fundamental values. And it's like, based on my understanding, it had nothing to do with wealth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And religion is, I think, in so many ways can be abused by governments, that the people who wield that sort of like Christian power they're not necessarily actually acting Christians. And I think that's something that can be broken down in another episode that is Ode, which is like anthropology of religion and talking about religion in a broader sense and how it interacts with us in our daily lives. And people who are, say, they're not necessarily religious actually come to find that basically in anthropology, we posit that essentially everybody is religious and ritualistic in some way. And that core belief system is not ever really the problem. It is the abuse of it that is the problem.
100%. And I think that's kind of what I am speaking to is, you know, the abuse of these things. It's like, it just seems like, speaking again from this cultural perspective and the cultural story here, there's just a lot of abuse tied to some of these concepts. And it's just interesting to think through and talk about.
Absolutely. And that will absolutely get another episode as well.
We're keeping track.
I know, because I'm looking through my notes for this episode. Ooh, we still have a few things I wanted to hit here.
Here you go.
In a review, I want to sort of think back a little bit to our episode on scars. And particularly, we talked about medical scars. And the concepts that we talked about there were a lot about the savage slot. So when we talk about the savage slot, you know, we're talking about a very, very old anthropologist who once went to on a boat, I'm sure, went to some other land and saw other people and decided that they, in fact, were primitive and that they were basically burdened as Europeans to help them become as advanced as these Europeans were, even though people from other places, like we talked about with cultural relativism, are not on the same scale. They did not believe that in that era of anthropology. And so that savage slot was created. Now, even though we now denounce literally that practice, this savage slot plays out in so many ways. So I'm curious your thoughts about the savage slot and how you see that playing out in conversation. I know that we gave a lot of time to that in the last episode. Just curious to hear you. I think that if you can imagine it on the broader scale, I think an example of the savage slot would be how perhaps white Americans discuss Buddhism as a very peaceful and pure religion, when in fact the history of Buddhism is like the history of all religions, really, and is complex and complicated, and it deals with its own systems of power and everything like that. So is a white American refers to Buddhism as peaceful and pure, they are essentially slotting them into the savage slot.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah, I feel that, you know, that was a really, really, that was what, episode 3, was it?
This was actually episode 5, I believe, if the last episode we did.
Awesome. I think it was a really, really interesting episode, and it got me thinking about that more. I feel that part of it is, and you can see it, you know, playing out in modern life, is that people aren't necessarily talking to each other. They're talking either about other people or talking down to people. It's like, instead of let me go talk to a Buddhist or a group of Buddhists and really understand, it's more like, well, I think this is what it is. They seem like they're peaceful, so they must be peaceful. And that's the framework that they're using, passing that on to other people, as opposed to actually taking the time to actually sit and have a conversation with these people to try to understand, well, what exactly do you think or believe or feel? Or what are your thoughts about that? That takes, I think, a lot of courage to do those kinds of things. And I think it's very easy for people to make up stories about what other people are about or what they're doing. But I think, you know, there's a lot that's lost when you're observing people, talking about them, or talking down to them, but you're not actually talking to them.
Yeah, and I think observing them is a good phrase there, because I would say that people who are in the savage slaughter are often somewhat distant. I think that's something that we see pop up in wartime quite a bit, is if you have a perceived victim, or, you know, it is your view that a certain group of people are being wronged in a distant war, the reaction is often to say that those people are so pure. And I think that's an interesting reaction that is almost counterintuitively stripping so many people of the complexity and the narrative and the historical context that they've always existed in. And also just the agency of being human, you know, that truly no person is so pure, and that our complexity actually is our power.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that they brought that up, because what I notice is, you know, there's this tendency to want to have things be yes or no, right or wrong, or black and white. And it's easy for marketing or whoever, you know, puts out these messages. This is a good person and that's the bad person. This is the hero and this is the victim. And say, well, maybe the victim isn't necessarily always a victim. Maybe there's some issues there, that because you're just viewing them from this one angle, you're missing some other things. And it's not to say that they were victimized in a particular situation, but like you're saying, if you put this kind of blanket concept on people, you know, we're perhaps missing out on a whole lot more to the story. But who has time to really dig into the story anymore? It's, you know, like I said, these messages and memes get pumped out, and they want it to be clear. Black and white, yes, no, right, wrong, victim, perpetrator, hero, villain.
Absolutely.
That's it, right?
And the victims, like you're saying, it's in this one context that they are victims, that should never discount the fact that they are genuinely being victimized in this certain context. But someone doesn't have to be pure to be victimized. People can be wronged even if they have done things that are wrong in the past. So I think that's something interesting that is such a cultural tick almost, where people see something wrong happen and then everything about them is necessarily pure. It's like, it reminds me of like a YA book or something where a character has died before the story starts, mm-hmm. and that person was simply the greatest person in the world. Never done any wrong. And mm-hmm. I think that's like, it's not realistic and it's not human, and it's fine for a YA novel, but it does have implications to view people as pure and simple.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of patronizing when you think about it, or it's not seeing the person with a complex human being, a wide range of experiences. You know, it's not seeing the person for who they really are. And it's oftentimes, like you say, groups of people, where it's like this group of people, they're, you know, pure and innocent. And like, is that really true? And why is it so important that you present that portrait of them?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly the problem with it. And I think that's, if there's something from the series that I hope people take away, this is one that I really want to challenge, is the way that we think about and talk about people as they're perceived to be victims, as they're perceived to be perpetrators, and think about when we call somebody peaceful and pure and simple, what are we actually saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to learn more, you can go back and watch all the episodes from Life and Anne. Lily does a great job of laying the groundwork for these concepts that we're now talking about. And it's great to kind of dig deeper and to think about how it impacts both of our lives and maybe people that we know as well. And I know other people will probably be able to think through those things. It's like, oh, yeah, you know what? The power dynamics of my own life. Because a lot of it just feels like it's something that people know and intuitively understand, but they don't have the vocabulary for it necessarily.
Yeah, and I thought it was always just vocabulary for me too, but it's actually turns out that when you apply words and concepts to it, you start to see it come to life a lot more. That it's, you know, yes, you always recognize these phenomena, but you did not necessarily understand how pervasive it is, or what other structures it relates to. And I think that the first step in ever making progress is understanding where progress is needed. And I think anthropology is a great tool for the individual to use to observe their own life. So that's why we're here with Life and Ant.
And we're leaning into the life part of it, right?
Yes, exactly. We're helping people ruin parties with their newfound knowledge.
Of course, like over the fruit punch bowl. Did you hear about the edict and image? Did you hear about that?
Yes.
What are your thoughts about it?
Yes. You definitely become more academic at parties after studying anthropology.
What are your thoughts about touchy subjects? Have you had anyone?
Exactly.
But I think that, you know, they're great to think about because it, you know, I feel that if you can give voice to things, it makes them less scary sometimes, or it can allow people to see situations for what they really are, you know, or maybe not. It can go both ways, but it really helps to, you know, back to your original question, you know, my thoughts about it. It's really helped me to break down some of these larger concepts and understand, okay, there's some anthropological underpinnings. And that's the other thing. I think anthropology is like a part of everything without being like this science, like biology or physics or chemistry.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. I had a great professor in college who always said, if people do it, we study it.
Now, to follow up on that, do anthropologists offer up solutions, or is it just a matter of observing and noting?
We attempt to offer solutions. I think that part of the anthropological code is that the first step truly is understanding how everything is related before we can be positive actors in these structures. And I think, so a good example of this is there was like an NGO who sort of specialized in rebuilding in poor communities after natural disasters. And they came in to a specific community. I'm a little shaky on the details, so I'm going to have to get you the specifics after the fact. But I believe what happened was there was a natural disaster and houses were required to be rebuilt. I won't say the name of the famous NGO, but they built up all of these houses without consulting the local people. And in about a month, the houses had fallen back down because they built them on a cliff and weren't actually fundamentally aware of the physics of building on this cliff the way that the local people were. So then a small local NGO came and in a much slower schedule on a lower budget, rebuilt houses that were not necessarily as flashy or whatever it was, but they built them in partnership with the local people. And those houses actually, without the sort of money and the government backing, they were able to provide for these people in a way that this other NGO was not able to. And I think that when we think about solutions, understanding is so key in providing solutions. And just to draw that out a little bit, when you don't understand something, you can swat at the wrong problems. The problem isn't necessarily just that the house isn't there right now. The problem is that if you build a sloppy house on top of it, it's just going to fall down again. And so I think when we talk about anthropology, a lot of it is to say, here is some understanding we can't fix it all right now, but there are small ways, like always consulting the people who are experts within their culture for solutions within that culture. And I think that's probably the largest answer there, is that the people who are actually actively living it are the experts on it and would know best how to serve it. So in many circumstances where there's maybe an abuse of power, things are moving more slowly, there's resistance within some communities to what is supposed to be very helpful for them. Oftentimes, what is missing there is an understanding.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring that up, because, you know, we're out here in California and we recently had this LA fires, and I know that that was something that was really an issue that was, I think, vexing for many of the people there. They wanted to make sure that they weren't left out of the rebuild process, and they wanted their voices heard. And I know that there was certain communities, you know, real effort to make sure that the local community was a part of that conversation. You know, seemed like a no-brainer to me. I don't know why that would be really that hard, but I guess if you have people that think that things should be a certain way, they're not necessarily thinking that they should maybe consult the people that want to be living there. I don't know why, like I said, but yeah, so there's that.
Yeah, I think the misunderstanding there would be that people think that because something worked somewhere, it's going to work somewhere else. So because the house that they built here stands tall, the house that they build there, so long as they follow the same formula, is going to stand tall as well. When the reality of it is that there are simply different circumstances that require different solutions. And when we look at cultural things, you know, not using the house metaphor anymore, when we look at maybe like we look at something like school districts, what raises test scores in one school district is not going to raise test scores in another. You can't walk in as somebody who like allegedly helped raise test scores in one community and assume that that's going to raise test scores in another. You must consult the people who are actually actively living with these students, because they know what's going to help them better than you can just because you saw it happen through one formula once.
And that's a really good example, because, you know, I did teach, I have taught in different school districts and different schools, you know, over the years. And I think oftentimes what happens based on my observation is, you know, people are, you know, trying to find some solution. They saw that this happened over here, or maybe there's some consultant that was making a proposal. So they're like, okay, let's go for it. Because people want, they want something to happen. They want it to happen now, you know. So, you know, that's understandable. But at the same time, you know, it takes a lot to really think through, well, what about this particular school district? What's unique to our community? How can we best reach our community? Well, maybe, once again, maybe we should have a conversation with our community. Right?
Yes. I think that's, and that's so much of the battle, is then conceding that power to the people who are the experts within that space. You know, they always ask in anthropology, who is the expert, the professor, the doctorate who studied the Holocaust, or the Holocaust survivor? And it is, the answer is both are, actually,
yeah,
in very different ways. There's the sort of positivist theory that, you know, if you know the facts, you know it. And then there's the phenomenological theory that if you lived it, you know it. And I think that's something that we need to see more respect for. The phenomenological side of the equation is, you know, trusting people who actually live with these circumstances, that they sometimes know better than you do. You know, you may have the math, you may have the formulas for it, and that's great, and that's necessary. You're an expert on that. But there are people who are actively living it. They're going to know what has and has not worked, what might work going forward, better than you will.
And just a comment on that, the whole idea of experts and things of that nature. You know, I've noticed that in some political situations and settings, there's like a very anti-expert sentiment that's been going on actually for 3 years now. Not always really sure what that's about, but well, I kind of do. But now there's, you know, there's a lot of a lot of people that don't necessarily want smart people around for all kinds of reasons, you know, some obvious and some not so obvious. And it's also, you know, another way to demean groups of people and put people down and say, oh, don't listen to them, listen to me. And, you know, I agree with you. So, well, why does it have to be just one expert in a group? Why can't people just share their experiences and all of that kind of be collected and thought through and then solutions come from there versus this one person who's, you know, I just don't believe that there's one person that has the answers to a lot of things anyway.
Yeah. And I think that's so much of the work there is not really believing that there really is someone who holds the answer. So that we have to always be looking for a new way to think about things. And I think that's the solution. If to answer your question from before, the solution that finance anthropology offers, I think that's largely what we hope will come of it, is that more voices are heard. And that when more voices are heard, we'll have a greater understanding of each other. And when we have a greater understanding of each other, then we can start to build.
I think that's great. And I think that it's what's necessary. And I think, you know, I would imagine that the anthropological perspective is that everyone's voice is important in the conversation, right?
Absolutely. That's why we have
That's why we have remind everybody about interlocutors.
Yes, exactly. They're the phenomenological experts on the subject. They are the ones we talk to in our ethnographies. The anthropological essay format is the ethnography. And when we go into the field, we study with the local people, the people who are living it, the people who contribute to our work are our interlocutors.
So, yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot we all can learn about that because, you know, there's nothing like your own personal experiences, right? But having said that, they're your personal experiences, which are specific to you and the situations that you're in, which are going to be very different from yours. But how do we leverage all of those experiences, especially if we're trying to, assuming that people are trying to find solutions for, because not everybody is, but many people are. How do you leverage all of that to, you know, find some common ground and move the needle on some things? I'm all for needle moving.
Well, I hope that in season two, we can do some more needle moving. I'm super excited about this new phase. I think we have done a thorough review of the concepts that we covered in season one. I'm super excited about everything that's to come. I already gave a little sneak peek into some ideas I have for episodes to come. So stay tuned for that. And go ruin some parties with your newfound knowledge.
So we're going to continue in next season. Be on the lookout for more mystifying the ordinary and these great conversations, because I think it's important. I think there's a need and there's a want. People want to know how they can be a part of the solution, and they aren't just necessarily interested in a lot of hot air, but they're interested in really in thinking through a lot of these topics, having conversations, hearing what other people have to say. And I think the anthropological framework is a great place to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Kim. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.